Deutsche Welle, Living Planet. We begin this week's edition of Living Planet trying to see the forest for the trees. I'm your host, Saroja Coelho, and we're strolling now into a forest in Canada. Now, as we wander around the bent trunks and step over knobby, exposed roots, we'll find out that the rough bark, twisted branches, and fluttering leaves are valuable sources of natural medicine. Now, many of the drugs used in our hospitals and pharmacies come from plants and trees. By the time they reach you, plant extracts are packaged into pills or mixed into serum. For example, you probably have willow bark in your bathroom cabinet and don't even realize it. Willow bark contains salicylic acid, the main ingredient in aspirin. Modern medicines include ingredients from thousands of different plants. Extracts from the Pacific yew tree are used to stop cancer cells from dividing. The rose periwinkle is used to treat leukemia and diabetes. The botanical world has provided us with powerful weapons in the fight against illness. Well, our first story on this week's edition takes us into a Canadian forest cultivated by a woman who calls herself a scientific tree hugger. Dr. Diana Beresford-Kruger has cultivated a phenomenal forest with tree species from all over the world. Her forest lies just outside the Canadian capital, Ottawa, and includes natural wonders like the Carpathian walnut and the cucumber tree. Now, she believes that we've barely begun to understand the value of forests. Our correspondent, Sean Griffiths, braced for the cold, it's still winter in Canada, and went for a stroll in Beresford-Kruger's magical forest.
It's a gloriously sunny day today. Although it feels like minus 20 degrees Celsius outside, and there's fresh snow on the ground, Dr. Diana Beresford-Kruger is in a ready mood to lead me on a tour of the forested grounds of her rural retreat here, just outside of Ottawa.
It was just a series of fields. There were 60 acres, and it had been a dairy farm.
That was about 30 years ago. Today, this fertile farmland has yielded hundreds of trees which soar majestically into the blue skies above. This forest laboratory is Diana Beresford-Kruger's life's work. She's proud of the fact that she's bred virtually all of these trees herself, from seed. It's her own Noah's Ark.
What we have here, to our left, is the Alley of Black Walnuts, all the way along the line there.
She first fell in love with trees as a student of botany in her native Ireland.
I remember looking at it and was told it was a sumac, and they told me it was a North American tree. Well, a North American tree, I'd never seen anything like it before.
But it wasn't until she immigrated to Canada that the idea of having her own personal forest as a research garden dawned on her. She just felt that trees weren't getting the respect they deserved.
I noticed that in Canada nobody was protecting the forests and nobody was planting all these rare, wonderful, fabulous, fantastic trees. I found that some of them were endangered. The tree has got a genome which is much more complex than ours. The tree is a factory for the manufacture of food, which feeds us and feeds all of nature. The tree is much more sophisticated than the human being.
And, she tells me in her rapid-fire Irish lilt, she's travelled the globe to add to her nursery.
Now, we're coming into a huge tree here, which is called Juglans regia, and that's the Carpathian walnut. I have really a collection of those.
It's a massive tree.
It's a massive tree, and that has come from the Carpathian Mountains.
The range of trees and their combined tree power here is impressive. It's all about biodiversity, says Diana.
Think about this. I'm going to get you to eat a carrot every day for the rest of your life, and that's all you're going to eat. That means there is very little biodiversity in your meals, in your food. Biodiversity brings in health. Biodiversity for the planet, if you want to look at it as a unity, means that the trees have the ability to feed all of nature. Not one tree, many thousands and thousands of trees. One species of tree is responsible for 40 types of insects. The beneficial insects rely on the forest. The forest relies on our food. The food comes to our table and we eat it.
Biodiversity in trees means diverse benefits for humans. She points to species she says can mitigate the effects of Parkinson's, cancer, and the scourge of Africa, malaria. There's a tree for that too. It was once popularly used by North American Aboriginal people when they were hit by outbreaks.
And that one is called the cucumber tree. It's about 20 feet tall and it's absolutely glorious. It has a quinone compound in it, which they used against malaria. There's only one or two of those trees left actually in Canada.
And she also believes that trees can play a leading role in mitigating the impacts of climate change. Dr. John Stone of Carleton University in Ottawa has long been associated with the UN's Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He believes that while the role of trees is important in combating climate change, the issue is a broad one.
So there are things that we can do to mitigate climate change through use of wise use of trees, but they're only part of the problem. The bigger part of the problem has to do with our burning of fossil fuels for energy. We're clearly can't carry on at the present rate because temperatures will rise higher and higher. The threat will get greater and greater, and that's not welcome news. So we're going to have to wean ourselves off our addiction to fossil fuels. We're going to have to go to renewable energy.
But Diana believes the role of trees is front and centre in the battle against climate change. She blames severe flooding in Europe this winter on the razing of ancient forests, which is why she's so concerned about the future of the ancient boreal forest. It stretches around the top of the globe from Canada and Alaska through to Russia and into Western Europe. She believes it should be granted special protection by the UN Heritage Body, UNESCO.
That forest is the last great forest left on the planet, and it is the forest that actually maintains the greatest amount of oxygenation and water vapour on the planet. That forest manages the great ocean currents, and those forests actually rule the weather patterns of the planet. And if they start coming down, which they are, with the taking down of the tar sands, which they are right now, and the tar sands is not a small area, it's three times the size of Ireland and growing. Think about that on the map.
Promoters of Canada's tar or oil sands development, like Canada's Prime Minister Stephen Harper, argue that the area fulfills an enormous demand for fuel, creates thousands of jobs, and provides energy security. Diana argues that it's impossible to replace an ancient forest which has evolved over hundreds of years. She says that any further development has to be more forest-friendly. If she ever met Mr. Harper, over a strong cup of tea, of course, she says she'd give him a clear message.
You have an obligation to your children to make sure there's a future for those two kids. We need to get rid of climate change. We're going to do it by means of planting in forests. We're going to do it by means of maintaining forests. Have a moratorium on the boreal forests. Expand the forests that are here. We need to recoup this country. And maybe if we have a magnificent green country again, maybe the tourist trade will pick up. All kinds of interesting research and development. Have a modern look at the world and maintain our trees.
Till that day comes around, she'll be in her forest, entering the country trying to convince Canadians of the power and importance of maintaining the country's trees. Shan Griffiths, DW, Ottawa, Canada.
We're leaving the lush winter forests of Canada and heading to the other side of the planet. We're landing in Pakistan, a country where blackouts are common and energy supply is one of the most pressing concerns. Energy was a major issue in the general elections last May when the country's now Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif promised to end crippling shortages. His government plans to solve the problem by building nuclear power plants with help from China. There's a major challenge on the ground, though. Local communities, including the fishing village that we're about to visit, are worried about life in the shadow of the reactors. Shadi Khan Saif brings us this report.
Abdul Rahman Ghat is a centuries-old fishing village on the coastline near Pakistan's financial hub, Karachi. In the narrow streets, small houses built with concrete bricks are home to hundreds of fishermen. The heat of scorching sun has turned their skin dark. Just a few kilometers west of this village, the Pakistani government has decided to build two nuclear power plants, Kanab 2 and Kanab 3. They are part of already existing Karachi nuclear power complex. For most local people here, life starts and ends in this small village. The sea is the town's most important asset. Ahmed Baloch has lived here for decades. The 75-year-old, dressed today in white turban and long white robes, has witnessed the transformation of old sailing ships into electric ones and woolen nets changing into the more durable ones made with nylon and silk. But what has got him worried is how nuclear power in the area will affect his fishing.
We are poor fishermen with relatively small ships. We remain near the shoreline and cannot go after fish in the deep water. Now, with the nuclear plants under construction near here, the marine security people do not allow us freedom of movement in the water. What are we going to do?
Baloch is referring to the two nuclear power plants that got approved last year. The financial and technical aid is coming from China. The security is done by local forces. Fear of a terrorist attack on the sites has led to massive security precautions around the plant, which extends to security control out into the sea. An old TV set connected to a video player sits on a bench in an improvised tea stall. It's the main source of entertainment for the youth here. But in central Karachi, it's a separate story. Business and entertainment is picking up. Industry is getting mechanized. And in quest for quick energy to meet the rising demand, the Pakistani government has opted to invest in nuclear power around the country. The country faces enormous electricity shortfalls, currently to the tune of 6,000 megawatts. This results in blackouts for up to 8 to 10 hours on an average day. Major cities have witnessed regular protests and demonstrations against the power blackouts, which is sometimes dispersed by authorities with force. Environmentalist Ali Arsalan is a vocal anti-nuclear power activist. He says the country should stop producing more power and work to conserve what it is already producing.
You know, we have an amazing situation now that on the national grid, at least 30% is lost because it travels over 1,000 kilometers to Karachi. Distribution system is bad. Now 30%, imagine. If you could halve it, you don't need any more production of electricity.
Recently, in order to improve their public image, the Pakistan Atomic Energy Commission invited journalists to come and speak with scientific and security officers in Karachi Nuclear Power Complex. At the meeting, Asfar Minhaj, the project director of Karachi's newest plants, is very confident about the prospects of the nuclear power.
No renewable energy source is proven to provide electricity with 100% efficiency throughout the year. They can only be cost-effective if they can provide enough power for the peak demand of the area.
Minhaj was quick to dismiss concerns about any future nuclear disaster.
We will never release the water that cools the nuclear reactors outside from the plant. There are going to be so many barriers to ensure safety.
But fishing interest groups and environmental activists are not convinced. Last month, a national advocacy campaign was launched in Karachi campaigning against nuclear plants. One of Pakistan's most celebrated nuclear scientists, Dr. Pervez Hoodbhai, is amongst the leaders of this campaign.
Developed countries like Germany and Switzerland have decided to get rid of nuclear plants. But here in Pakistan, India, Saudi Arabia and Bangladesh, we want to develop nuclear plants quickly. With nuclear plants, you can never be 100% sure that an accident isn't going to happen. We have a very clear example of this in Fukushima, Japan.
His colleague Dr. A.H. Nair deplored the non-serious attitude of the government officials in case of an emergency.
When I asked the nuclear authority what would be their plan in case of any disaster at the plant, they simply said that the houses in Karachi are made of concrete, unlike the wooden houses near Fukushima. So we will ask people to stay indoors and no one will be affected.
China has assured Pakistan a grant of $6.5 billion, around 4.7 billion euros, for the nuclear power plants, and construction work has already begun. Authorities do seem 100% sure of the plant's safety and have made their minds up to go ahead with the building despite all the concerns raised. Here is Asfar Minhaj, the project director of the plants, again.
It is unfair to say that China is a new player in nuclear technology and that it would be unwise to get a plant from them. They are an emerging power in this industry, and we are going to be responsible for quality and safety controls.
For the fishermen in Abdul Rahman Ghat, though, life has to go on. Most of them say that they can't worry about a nuclear disaster happening on their doorstep. They are still worried about the future of their local fishing industry, though, and hope that they will be allowed to fish the coastal areas without interruption. They say they don't have the equipment to head further out to sea to cast their nets. Shadi Khan Saif, DW, Abdul Rahman Village, Karachi.
We're sticking with the issue of energy shortages in South Asia, but heading over the border into India. Here, too, many people are plunged into darkness as rolling blackouts hit, sometimes on a daily basis. The Indian economy is growing, the population is booming, and that means the nation needs power, more and more of it. But here, innovation might be the key. A new collaboration between the government and technologists could spare Indians the trouble of power outages, reduce reliance on diesel generators, and boost the use of renewable solar energy. Murali Krishnan has more from Chennai in the state of Tamil Nadu.
Long power cuts on a daily basis are common in Tamil Nadu. It severely affected industrial and agricultural belts, with the disruption of thousands of micro, small, and medium enterprises, including weaving and textile units. So it's perhaps no surprise to find a delighted Uday Kumar, a small businessman from Madurai in Tamil Nadu. He's happy that a new technology is being tested in homes in his area. He hopes the technology will guarantee a continuous power supply from the grid, even during outages. For the last year or more, because of power cuts, many of us suffered, especially our businesses. But if the government manages to power up our lives and gives us minimum supply of energy, we greatly welcome it. The new technology is being developed locally by engineers at the Indian Institute of Technology in Chennai. The uninterrupted direct current, or UDC, promises to supply electricity from the grid to power basic appliances such as fans, TVs, lights, and mobile phone chargers, even when demand is high. The project is the brainchild of the institute's director, Bhaskar Ramamurthy, and electrical engineering professor, Ashok Junjunwala, a member of Indian Prime Minister's Scientific Advisory Council. Ramamurthy explains the technology behind the UDC.
What we have done in the UDC is to find a way to give 100 watts of power to each household, 24/7. You do this by adding some minimal amount of equipment in the substation. Do no changes on the distribution system at the street level. When you come into the home, you add one more small device before the meter, and you supply the consumer, apart from the AC power which he gets today, you supply a second output of power, which is 48 volts DC. But this outlet will give you 48 volts DC, 100 watts only. But it will give it to you 24 hours a day. Even when they do load shedding, it turns out that in the new system that we are proposing, there's no shedding. Instead of having a blackout, they do what we call a brownout.
Consumers who opt for the scheme will have to spend around 1,000 Indian rupees, which is less than 12 euros, for a device at home. On top of that, people will have to buy LED bulbs and fans that run on DC power. Krishna Vasudevan, who is also part of the team, says the new system will guarantee power to millions of homes, even when sufficient electricity is not available in the grid.
Yes, it will help in a very large way because it allows uninterrupted electricity supply from the grid itself, which enables the grid to at the same time shed load in a sense, because it is reducing its load, and it helps the users because it is now supplying uninterrupted electrical supply. And therefore, this will go a very long way in helping alleviate the starved situation in India.
The UDC system has been tested in only a few homes, but it's been introduced for proof of concept demonstration in the four southern states of Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, Kerala, and Andhra Pradesh on a pilot basis. If successful, the pilot could be rolled out across the country. The effectiveness of the system is such that even large complexes can consider enhancing basic DC with solar power and reduce their dependence on expensive diesel generators. In the long run, this system can even run alongside the smart meters being considered. Vasudevan again.
The interface unit has the ability to absorb input from solar, and therefore at the time when the user decides that they want additional capability of loading, they can simply invest on the solar panel alone and interface it to the unit that we have designed.
So will the UDC be a game changer for power-starved India? Institute Director Bhaskar Ramamurthy.
We don't see any other reasonably good solution for giving this lifeline power support for all households. We actually see this also getting used in different parts of the world because it checks all the boxes. Even if you have an area where there's no power shortage, you can incentivize people to go to energy efficient appliances. The whole idea is this can go all over the world for various reasons, not necessarily the reasons for which it is important for India.
Mr. Jhunjhunwala agrees.
I think it's a very simple idea, but real huge gains are possible. So I think if we do it right, India has a game-changer technology. That's my feeling. It has to take it all the way.
Murali Krishnan, DW, Chennai, South India.
Our last piece on today's edition of Living Planet takes us back to a question we've asked a lot more in recent months. Who is responsible for the people displaced by climate change? They're not officially recognized as refugees, which means the international community isn't required to offer them asylum. But global warming is changing weather patterns and pushing coastlines further inland. Whole communities are disappearing beneath the waves. The first claim for climate refugee status was made in New Zealand last year. It was denied by the courts, but there is an appeal going through this spring. The case opens up a lot of politically sensitive questions about who caused climate change and who will suffer because of it. At the moment, industrialized nations are offering funds for climate protection, but they're not opening their borders. Vanessa O'Brien has more.
Nearly 30 super typhoons tore through the Western Pacific last year. In December, a Category 5 storm pounded the Pacific Islands of Tonga, resulting in one death and widespread devastation.
Tongan authorities say they've now made contact with most of the smaller islands battered by Cyclone Ian. The Category 5 cyclone caused widespread damage at the weekend.
A few weeks before that, in neighbouring Southeast Asia, Super Typhoon Haiyan killed more than 6,000 people in the Philippines. That storm was the strongest ever recorded at landfall. Scientists are predicting that extreme weather events in the Pacific will double over the next century. What does that mean for low-lying nations like the islands of Kiribati? With most of its land only a few metres above sea level, Kiribati has already experienced damage from storms and flooding. Some of its land has already vanished beneath the Pacific, and it's expected that within 30 years, rising sea levels will swallow Kiribati forever.
When Kiribati disappear, we're going to die with our kids.
Ioane Teteota has lived in New Zealand for the past 6 years. He doesn't want to return to Kiribati and is fighting a landmark court case to claim refugee status as a victim of climate change.
We said when New Zealand tell us to go back, and we really said.
But New Zealand's High Court turned down Teteota's application in December. His lawyer has since filed an appeal, and now Teteota, his wife and their three children are waiting to find out if they will be deported to the sinking shores of Kiribati. His wife, Angua Erika, wants to see rich nations take responsibility.
They are big countries and they can help us, like those who are on like small islands, that they get deal with the climate change. They are powerful country. that they can help us.
New Zealand's High Court accepted evidence that Kiribati will likely disappear within 30 years. Te Aotearoa's lawyer, Dr. Michael Kidd, says it's not the science of climate change that the world is questioning. It's the liability. Kidd says the court was afraid that by accepting one climate change refugee, New Zealand would establish precedent for ever altering refugee law in the Pacific and possibly around the world. Right now, people who are forced from their homes by changes in the local environment are not officially recognised as refugees and are not protected by international laws. Kidd has been very critical of the judge, New Zealand High Court Justice John Priestley.
He said, oh my God, if we allow this case, there'll be literally millions of people around the world who will start claiming a refugee status and the governments will be overwhelmed.
Kidd says that industrial activity, consumption and waste in rich nations have contributed to global warming. He sees this as an indirect form of persecution and he wants rich nations to open up their borders.
Well, there's a huge amount of denial, isn't there? And Justice Priestley, with due respect, perpetrates that denial by saying that it's a question of foreseeability that, and there's no actual malice involved with polluting the atmosphere and, you know, indirectly causing flooding. So therefore, how can the West be responsible? That's an approach I, with respect, call a head-in-the-sand approach, if I can use that.
The tiny nations of the Pacific include some of the lowest-lying islands in the world. In addition to Kiribati, Vanuatu, Tuvalu, parts of Papua New Guinea and the Marshall Islands are considered extremely vulnerable to damage caused by storms and surging seas. The question of who is to blame will become increasingly important as they struggle to adapt or are forced from their homes. Where will they go and who will pay? There is a growing voice calling for open borders. In 2009, politicians in Bangladesh called on the UN to widen the scope of what defines a refugee. They wanted people fleeing climate change-damaged regions to be granted the same protection as people fleeing political repression. But New Zealand doesn't seem to be moving in that direction. According to politician Dennis O'Rourke, New Zealand has no duty to take in people affected by climate change.
I don't think that's appropriate because I don't see these people as refugees in the classic sense. I think that they're a special category and have to be looked at as such, and that's why I keep talking about a strategy for dealing with it.
O'Rourke believes that if New Zealand opens up this way, it will be overwhelmed by refugees and will lose control of its borders.
I think it's probably not a good idea for New Zealand to take one country like Kiribati and say, we'll do a special deal for you, because that lets the rest of the world off the hook, and that's not appropriate.
O'Rourke isn't alone in his views. The US, the European Union, Australia and China have all been accused of failing to aid those affected by climate change. That's why Ioane Te Aotearoa's lawyer, Michael Kidd, says nations can't be left to make this decision. He plans to continue his push for a change in the definition of a refugee to include those displaced by climate change.
I'm not particularly a passionate greenie. I'm more coming from it from a Christian perspective because I'm also a pastor. And I believe that God ordained mankind to look after the planet and share its proceeds. And climate change is, along with increasing inequality, due to mankind's mismanagement of the planet.
In the meantime, instead of taking people in, New Zealand has decided to invest about €50 million in Pacific climate protection. This money will be invested in renewable energy initiatives, water infrastructure and cyclone shelters. The country is also committed to reducing its carbon emissions. The question is, will this action be enough to save the lives of people who are watching their island homes disappear beneath the waves? Vanessa O'Brien, DW, Auckland, New Zealand.
And that's it for this edition of Living Planet. I'm your host, Saroja Kwelam, and I'll be back again next week with more news and stories about the environment. In the meantime, you can visit us anytime at dw.de/environment. From everyone here in studio, thanks for listening and see you next time. No.
said you felt so happy you could die. I told myself that you were right for me.